I do wonder, well, you know, why in the richest state in the richest country in the world are the people living in economic, you know, despair?
Venezuela promises another round of fuel vouchers for rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 30th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the University of Alaska works on its budget proposal in tough economic times.
The top priority, you know, continues to be maintaining existing buildings to fix the roofs and the plumbing and the HVACs and things like that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
The White House says the economic stimulus plan has created or saved 2,315 jobs in Alaska so far. The Obama administration released the latest numbers today on the effects of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Overall, it either created or saved 640,000 direct jobs as of the end of September, according to self-reporting done by stimulus money recipients. The White House says so far nearly $200,000 have been pumped into Alaska, which is in line to get $1.2 billion overall. The administration is touting the progress as a success, but some Republicans and other critics of the stimulus plan say they don't buy the numbers. Alaska Congressman Don Young's office put out a press release today complaining that the Alaska jobs so far created are not close to the 8,000 promised. The White House says it will hit that target by the end of next year. The Vice President's senior economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, says the nation is facing a job market challenge from the economic downturn that's not been seen since the Great Depression.
The fact that the Recovery Act is on track to save or create 3.5 million jobs before it's done is going to put a big dent in that jobs deficit, but it's not going to totally offset that. There is no plausible economically or fiscally responsible Keynesian stimulus that could fill a hole that large.
The White House says the jobs are in both the private and public sectors and range from teachers and police officers to construction workers. The Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act cost $789 billion. The Naknek Electric Association was recently awarded the fourth largest grant in the nation from the latest round of federal energy stimulus funds to push the development of a geothermal power plant in Bristol Bay. From member station KDLG, Adam Kane reports.
Thursday, Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu announced that $338 million would be made available to support 123 geothermal projects in 39 states. Naknek Electric Association was awarded more than $12.3 million for further testing of the geothermal reservoir currently in the drilling phase on the east side of Bristol Bay. The current plan for NEA is to construct a 25-megawatt geothermal plant to supply electricity to numerous Bristol Bay communities. Donna Vukic is the general manager for NEA. She says that she is encouraged by the federal showing of support for the project.
We're encouraged that we might be able to finish what we started and expand on it to be able to serve and lower the energy costs in the Bristol Bay region. I think that we have a very viable region, and by doing this and by having the federal support of that is really showing that they see a reason for it in our area.
Vukic says that drilling and other work is still underway at the well site.
We have been receiving favorable results of our drilling and are very encouraged by it.
It is not known for certain if there is a usable geothermal source at the drilling site or not. However, Vukic says that there have been some good signs so far.
We have been drilling through multiple hydrothermal alteration areas, along with having an increased thermal gradient. So all the indicators are still there and very favorable.
She estimates that they have already completed roughly two-thirds of the approximately 12,000-foot well. And on top of the $12.3 million NEA recently received from the DOE, they are also receiving $2.5 million that Senator Murkowski included in the U.S. Senate Energy and Water bills, as well as $2.8 million that Senator Stevens had previously earmarked for the project. Some of the money will be used for work in the first well, although the majority of funds will be used for a second well. Vukic says that the drilling rigs have been winterized and that they have a sufficient amount of materials on hand to work on the second well throughout the winter. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Venezuela's U.S. Ambassador Bernardo Alvarez this week is in Alaska pledging to continue distributing vouchers for free fuel in villages this winter. The country's state-run oil company Citgo has been handing out 100-gallon fuel vouchers for rural native Alaskans since 2007, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Brad Garness has a box of letters he keeps from Alaskans who've received the free fuel. In some cases, the writers say they wouldn't have been able to heat their homes without it. Others say it allowed them to pay other bills they would have been delinquent on. But Garness remembers one elder's comments especially well. He said the voucher relieved a great stress in his life.
Traditionally, you know, in tribal cultures, especially indigenous tribes of Alaska, stress was not, you know, a commonly reoccurring thing. Our lives were very peaceful. And so one elder was telling me, he said, stress was temporary. You see a brown bear, you get stressed out, you know, and you resolve the situation and you continue moving on with very little stress. And you know, we have, you know, we're the richest state and the richest country in the world. And why do our people pay the most for heating oil? And that's really significant.
Garness is the executive director of the Alaska Intertribal Council, which handles the logistics of the program. He believes the vouchers have saved lives. He says not being able to pay for life's necessities leads to despair that then feeds a rise in alcoholism and suicide rates. He says the heating oil gift has a positive social benefit that goes beyond easing the strain on pocketbooks.
For the people of Venezuela to come and recognize the suffering that people are enduring in rural Alaska and to provide a heating oil gift, you know, from their side of the world up to us, I say that inside of itself carries a great message.
There is some controversy surrounding the program. After Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez called former President Bush the devil, a few communities said it would be unpatriotic to accept the aid. But Garnes says he'd be surprised if many refused the vouchers this winter.
We'll see here, you know, if there's any villages who aren't going to take that gift, but my instincts tell me that in most cases, the politics is all very secondary to the actual humanitarian aid that is required for people to, you know, live a comfortable lifestyle, if at that. You know, it's just it's very difficult to live in rural Alaska, and especially with increased fuel prices, and the people generally at the receiving end of it are not as interested in the politics as they are in keeping their family warm.
Garness wishes the state of Alaska would match the Venezuelan gift, and he says the state needs to come up with long-term solutions to the fuel crisis in rural Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unexplored archaeology sites could rewrite the story of the Aleut people.
So this is opening up a whole new world of what was going on out here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business, or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The U.S. Senate has passed the Interior Appropriations Bill, which now goes to President Obama for his signature. It totals $32.25 billion and includes $13 million for village sanitation, $2.5 million for preparing timber sales in the Tongass National Forest, about $6.5 million to rebuild Brooks Camp in Katmai National Park. It also contains nearly $2 million to reconstruct a campground at Chugach National Forest, as well as an infusion of funds for the Indian Health Service for compacting with tribes. The interior funding bill also contains money to fence the Campbell Airstrip in Anchorage. Both of Alaska's senators voted for the final version yesterday and touted the money it will send to Alaska. But Congressman Don Young joined most of his fellow House Republicans and voted against it. His office says he has issues with the Environmental Protection Agency and was uncomfortable with increases in its budget. The Interior Appropriations Bill also includes establishment of a Forest Service Fund to fight catastrophic wildfires, something Western lawmakers have been seeking. The Flame Fund, or Federal Land Assistance Management and Enhancement Act, is intended to deal with unforeseen large-scale wildfires so the Forest Service doesn't have to raid other programs to battle them. In past years, that's caused other forest management programs to run short. The bill also contains more than $6.3 million for oil spill research, and it calls for more scientific analysis into environmental concerns surrounding oil and gas development in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. President Obama is expected to sign the Interior Appropriations Bill into law. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has released its latest report on Arctic warming. The yearly update, called the Arctic Report Card, draws on monitoring of land, water, plants, and animals in the high latitudes. University of Alaska Fairbanks Geology and Geophysics Professor Vladimir Romanovsky is responsible for tracking changes in permafrost and hydrology. Romanovsky says the latest data shows some nuance to recent years' trends.
Permafrost started to accelerate in warming in Siberia during the last two, three years. In Alaska, on the North Slope, permafrost was not changing in terms of temperature too much during the last 5 to 6 years. However, we start to see some acceleration of warming again after this pause.
Romanovsky says the bump in warming did not extend into interior Alaska, and he believes that the coastal change reflects decreasing sea ice.
There's dramatic changes in sea ice. Even if this year the extent of summer sea ice was not as the previous 2 years, it's still much smaller than norm.
Romanovsky says there was also increased flow in some Arctic rivers. He says the rivers are not glacial-fed, and melting permafrost does not provide enough water to account for the kind of increase being measured.
There is some indication there was a little bit of increase in precipitation, but it seems like precipitation cannot explain this increase. So it definitely is something going on with permafrost, but it's still a little bit of mystery, so we're working on it.
Romanovsky says permafrost melting could be altering the drainage landscape and redirecting the flow of water. Continued evidence of change to vegetation and wildlife due to warming are also detailed in the latest Arctic report card. Archaeologists are planning two new projects in the Aleutians for next summer to expand their knowledge of Aleut cultures both before and after Russian contact. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with one of the lead archaeologists.
The first project is on Adak Island. U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist Debbie Corbett is working with Professor Diane Hansen from the University of Alaska Anchorage to look for inland sites.
We're having trouble deciding what to call them because is it an inland site on an island that's, you know, a couple miles wide? What's inland? But they're not on the coast, so they're in the passes between bays. They're on ponds. They're upstreams. And we found about 6 or 7.
Corbett says the sites range from 2 houses to 20, and it's unclear why they were placed at certain locations. Some could be for hunting ducks on a lake. Some could be for lookouts into the ocean, and others could be to isolate people for various reasons, like performing rituals or giving birth. But she says, really, it's all speculation at this point.
Traditionally, we haven't thought of Aleut people doing much in the interiors of their islands. So this is opening up a whole new world of what was going on out here.
They will excavate various sites on Adak to see what they reveal, such as bones of animals, tools, house structures, and other information. The other project will take place on Rat Island, which is part of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. Rats were eradicated from the island last fall. That means birds can safely start repopulating the area without their eggs or young being eaten. Researchers at Fish and Wildlife want to know what birds were there before the rats took over in the 1780s. To do that, archaeologists will look for bird bones in some of the 27 old village and cultural sites to see what people were hunting on the island. Corbett and archaeological student Carolyn Funk will also be looking for artifacts to show how Russian contact affected the area. In 2003, they identified one house that was split into two rooms in a more Russian style.
They were still using traditional tools and weapons and still had a traditional life, but they had started incorporating beads, trade goods from the Russians. So we think this is a real early site, and we want to keep digging in this particular site and this particular house and see if it can tell us more about what the Aleuts were willing to accept from the Russians and how they adjusted to these guys showing up on their doorsteps.
Corbett says the Russians frequently brought beads because they were lightweight and came in a large variety of styles that would appeal to many different people. But that didn't mean they were low-value items used to cheat the Aleuts.
You know, the way they're used on clothing and in decorative items conveys social information to other people. It's, you know, we're trading with the Russians, we're wealthy, we have these nice things, that kind of stuff.
Corbett says the larger blue beads had the most value. By some estimates, 100 beads had the same value as a kayak. Corbett says the archaeologists frequently find beads because they're very small and easily lost in dark houses and outdoors. Corbett says she and her colleagues plan to start all of the intensive excavations next summer. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents met in Fairbanks today to discuss its budget proposal for next year. Regents are starting with numbers put together by UA President Mark Hamilton and UA System Chancellors. UA spokeswoman Kate Ripley says the preliminary operating budget runs more than $865 million, including $350 million from the state. UA got $327 million in state funds last year, and Ripley says the goal this year is to make a realistic request.
The Board of Regents strived to do that over a number of different years and was closely aligned with the governor's request for a number of years and kind of got off track there for a couple of years. And so that's always what you strive to do, is get the governor's budget as closely aligned with the university's as possible.
Ripley says the operating budget request includes support for the new University of Alaska Fairbanks-based Center for Energy and Power, Climate Change Research, Engineering and Math Departments, as well as high-demand job training programs and student success initiatives. The regents are also taking a more focused approach to developing a capital budget to present to the state following disappointment last year when they asked for more than $600 million but got $3 million. Ripley says regents are moving away from the laundry list approach.
With the economic situation being what it is, it's just appeared prudent to all involved to pare down that list. And the top priority, you know, continues to be maintaining existing buildings, to fix the roofs and the plumbing and the HVACs and things like that.
Ripley says the draft capital budget regents are considering seeks $50 million for yearly maintenance, another $50 million for projects deferred from past years, as well as $88 million for the long-sought new life sciences facility at UAF, plus another $12 million for other projects. Regents did not vote today on the budget proposal, but instead delayed action until a future meeting. Whatever eventually gets approved by them will next go to the governor and later to the legislature. The University of Alaska Fairbanks may be educating the next generation of federal intelligence workers. UAF is being considered for selection as a National Intelligence Center for Academic Excellence. John Kelly, a UAF Marine Science professor who organized a recent meeting with U.S. intelligence officials, says the university has a mix of attributes that appeal to the federal intelligence agencies.
the sciences, research, languages, political science. But where it's unique is that it has an Arctic awareness. With a warming trend, there's the possibility that the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free, or at least nearly ice-free, which will involve a number of factors with international significance.
Kelly says a cross-section of UAF programs, including computer science and geography offerings, were among those highlighted during the two-day meeting earlier this month with the director of the Center for National Intelligence. He says UAF needs to develop a multidisciplinary intelligence training curriculum, but that the next step will depend on the federal government.
Until what is called a broad agency announcement comes out, which we estimate to be in about 12 months. At that time, we'll be able to compete with other universities for one of the grants, which will be roughly $3 million.
Kelly says the grants are to help selected universities prepare workers for federal intelligence agency jobs. Kelly says the government anticipates losing about a third of its intelligence workforce to retirement over the next 3 years.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This morning, Lisa Ebner was sworn in as the 14th postmaster in Anchorage and the first woman to hold the position in the city's history. Ebner has 26 years with the U.S. Post Office.
Now, Alaska is unique because of the way the state is set up. People really depend on us just for survival.
Ebner came to Anchorage in March of this year to serve as acting postmaster of the city's postal system. Today's ceremony officially installs her as postmaster. She started as a letter carrier and has been in management for 20 years of her service with the post office, having worked in her home state of Wisconsin and in Minneapolis and Denver.
I was asked to come up here, you know, to Anchorage to see, you know, what I could do with my background to help take it forward. You know, as you know, we're going through some challenging times, as of are a lot of businesses due to the economy.
Ebner says the way people use the postal system is changing due to internet use, overnight shipping companies, and the age of technology in general.
You know, things are very fluid with what we're seeing with our customer base, more so with our business customers, the type of mailings that they're doing. So we do some things internally to adjust to that. We also look at, you know, how we staff our windows, what type of transactions are we doing? How can we still service our customers, but in a way that maybe is a better fit for them? Specifically through, we have a lot of online things that we're trying to leverage, things like click and ship, where people can have everything prepared at home and their carrier will come and pick it up, and it's no additional cost to them.
She says younger people are inclined to use online postal services rather than use the retail offices. The Postal Service has been seeing a decline in mail volume over the past couple of years, and plunging revenues are a challenge. Ebner will oversee 13 stations and 471 employees in Anchorage. Invasive species experts from around Alaska converged on Ketchikan this week for the 10th annual Alaska Noxious and Invasive Plants Management Conference. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, scientists say we can expect invasive plants to continue to spread throughout Alaska, with coastal areas being hit the hardest.
With more than 570,000 square miles of land, ridding Alaska of all invasive plants is virtually an insurmountable task. Scientists participating in this week's Noxious and Invasive Plants Management Conference are focusing instead on halting new infestations and limiting the spread of invasive plants that have already established in the state. HDR Alaska ecologist Elizabeth Bella created various models to forecast the spread of 16 invasive plants within Alaska, looking at what habitats are suitable for plant growth and the habitats that may expand with global warming.
It's no longer thought to be immune by the threats that plague other parts of the world, invasive plant species infestations on a large scale. Better planning tools are needed to anticipate some of these areas of change and to strategize for the future.
What the models forecast is that the southern coastal areas of the state are most vulnerable to the spread of invasive plants, as are areas along the state's road system. Bella says the further north an area is, the less likely it would be infested by invasive plants. Patty Crossi, an invasive species coordinator for the Tongass National Forest, says a Forest Service is conducting invasive plant inventories across the Tongass. In the past, she says a Forest Service has introduced invasive plants through seed mixes used for vegetation along Forest Service roads.
Simply using a non-invasive seed mixture in our revegetation work is one way of preventing the further spread.
She says the Forest Service requires that some vehicles and equipment be washed to prevent the spread of invasive plants.
Primarily, we're focusing on our remote systems, our remote road systems that are not tied to communities. And the reason we're doing that is because we've still got a lot of work to do to work with our community so that we're all, you know, kind of doing this together. But on those road systems that we have a little bit more control over the interactions and the vehicular use and the vectors, if you will, we're choosing to start there.
Crossi says the Forest Service is also working on an early detection and rapid response program to deal with new infestations, but the program has met with some hurdles.
It's not as vigorous as I would like it to be, and that is because primarily of our need to do environmental analysis for this type of work.
Crossi says the Forest Service lacks the funding to complete full environmental impact statements for all of the areas it would like to treat. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
If Charlie Brown's pal Linus is looking for the Great Pumpkin, he should try the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center. A 319-pound donated pumpkin was turned into a giant gourd sculpture by Joe Falls, an art instructor from Kenai Peninsula College. The pumpkin came from J.D. Megchilson of Nikiski, who is no stranger to giant fruit. In 2006, he crushed the state record for the largest pumpkin, with one that weighed in at just over 1,000 pounds. Falls got to visit the pumpkin while it was still at Mengtulchin's patch, so she could start formulating ideas for how to best approach the project. The final design has two faces and will be lit from inside. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Adam Kane in Dillingham, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Mad Libs Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie the Axe Fight. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Beastmaster Peter and Dave You Can't Scare Me Waldron. And I'm Lori Zombie Slayer Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.